What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. John Krofcik and Larry Rifkin. And John, you and I are probably, I think this is probably fair to say, we're the only people in the entire world who right now are talking about this topic on a podcast.
Oh, now what is that topic?
Well, I've got to tell you, maybe it's being talked about in parlor games, in high finance, in remote circles around the globe. But we're bringing it right home to you. And that is the fact that America is the reserve currency for the world.
That's at the true. Moment. At the moment, I agree.
And that has incredible implications that we as Americans probably have no concept as to why that matters, or if that circumstance changes, why that may change our fortunes with it.
Well, our national policy, our international policy has really put us in a really bad position. I mean, with Russia, especially, I think, with Russia, because, they're not happy with us, and the Chinese aren't happy with us. So I know they're getting together, and that's not a good place to be.
So there are other cabals around the world getting
yes.
together. But before we get into this really fascinating topic about de-dollarizing the world, okay, that's what we're going to talk about. And you got to stay with us, because it really is incredibly interesting what's going on. And you'll never hear it.
You must know this. You got to know about this.
And you'll never hear it in the press. You really won't. Now I'm starting to sound like a conspiracy theorist.
Ooh.
I'm not,
but it's not
by any means. But I do want to bring you some other trends about finance just while we have a moment, John. Here's one that I read recently, and this is for those of you who are getting really fed up with what's going on in this country, and there are many, and also who can't stretch the dollars in retirement. A lot of people are moving to Central America, Costa Rica, other places like that, and they're living like kings and queens on $2,000 a month, John. Imagine
yeah,
that.
I've heard this. Costa Rica, yes. I've heard this.
Now, before they shut the doors and say, no more Americanos, you better get down there.
Well, I don't know. It kind of worries me, though, going to countries like that, because, you know, the regimes could change in those countries, and, you know, then maybe the 2000 isn't going to be enough.
Yeah,
you know?
Gee, we've got such stability here in the United States right now. Yeah, regimes. who try to use their political influence to influence others in our country from other places. Gee, I thought those were the banana republics. But having said that, I mean, you know, there are a lot of people looking to be expatriates, and they're leaving. My sister and brother-in-law go down to San Miguel Allende in Mexico, and it is replete with Americans. I mean, he ministers down there from time to time when they need a replacement minister, and this is a church that has them all the time, and they work them through the process, and he doesn't even have to speak in Spanish, because
wow.
It's all Americans.
It's all American. Wow. Yeah, I've heard about this trend. This is a very big growing trend.
Well, we're going to have to do something
yes.
more fully on that.
Yes.
But there's another trend, by the way, that relates to money before we get into our topic of the day. And that is that real estate values are plummeting in New York City. Now, I've read this from two different sources over the last 3 days, and I sent it to my son, who may be looking to buy real estate in New York, and that would be good if the prices came down a bit right now. But you think about that, John. I mean, what does that mean about the U.S. economy? I mean, we look at these large urban centers like Boston, New York, San Francisco, and the prices that
They're astronomical.
They're out of sight. They really are.
So maybe they're coming down to some real value, but it makes you wonder then what that means for the rest of us. As far
absolutely.
As
I mean, if, again, in your major cities, they're starting to come down, I don't know what kind of foreshadowing that is, but we'll keep our eye on that trend as well. So there were two very interesting money-related trends, but here's the one that really has long-term implications, and that is the world de-dollarizing. Now, our guest starts off his compelling article that got my attention, and let me read this to you, John. What if tomorrow nobody but the United States would use the U.S. dollar? Every country or society would use their own currency for internal and international trade, their own economy based non-fiat currency. So what if they didn't underpin their economy with U.S. dollars and have enough in reserve, because that's the way we trade in petrol, well, otherwise known as oil, around the world? And wasn't that an issue, remember, with Iraq?
Yes.
And Saddam Hussein?
Saddam didn't want to use the dollar anymore.
Wherever.
What's that? Of course, we all know what happened.
How that ended
him.
Up? Yes. Yeah, I guess we weren't too happy about that.
No.
The United States doesn't like it.
Our economic hitmen
are
out there.
There we go. Okay, John Perkins, a reference to you, a shout out to John Perkins. We should post some of our interviews with him. But now, you may be scratching your head out there asking us, Larry, John, what are you guys talking about? What does this mean? How is the U.S. all tied up with everyone else's money supply? And what does that mean to me sitting here in Oshkosh, Bigosh? What impact does that have to the U.S.? And if other nations began pulling out of the orbit of U.S. money, what effect would that have on our economy? I hope you're asking that question, because that's a really important one.
Oh, I think we'd see our economy crash, because, I mean, our money is only as good as because it's a fiat currency. There's nothing backing it. So if there's no, if nobody's taking it anymore, it's basically...
Yeah, well, it's of course on the basis that we have the strongest economy and the good faith of the U.S. government, and we've never, pulled back on any of our debt obligations. But as our guest Peter Koenig tells us, today the dollar is based not even on hot air and is worth less than the paper it's printed on.
Wow.
And we are so far in debt. We've talked about that on so many different podcasts. So have you ever really wondered how an indebted nation like ours just goes on in this state without seeming consequence, and whether, in fact, other nations are saying, you know, this country really needs to be put in its place? And I hate to say that, because we live here, we are Americans, but there's lots that we do around the globe, lots that we do with our money, with our Treasury Department, that's even more powerful than our Defense Department. Now, you got to hear this. You really do. And Peter Koenig is a fascinating guy. He's an economist and geopolitical analyst. He's also a former World Bank staff member, and he's worked all around the world. And we caught up with him in Europe, and he gave us just an incredible dissertation on de-dollarizing the world. Are you ready for it, John?
I think it's going to happen.
It is. Right now on America Trends.
With us on the line on America Trends is Peter Koenig. He is an economist and geopolitical analyst. He's a former World Bank staff member and of the World Health Organization. And he writes some incredible pieces about what's going on around the world and has a different voice than we often hear in the United States. The article that got my attention, Peter, was the one, "The World is De-Dollarizing." I don't even think we in America understand truly what it means to be the reserve currency of the world as the dollar has been. Explain what that means, how we got here, and then we'll get into the notion of de-dollarizing.
Okay. First of all, thank you very much, Larry, for having me on your important show. It's a pleasure for me to try to talk to this about this a little bit. It's, of course, as you and probably everybody who listens understands, it's a rather very complex issue, and I'm trying to make it as understandable as possible. So the little sort of introduction perhaps to this, and what most people don't realize, is that the big dollar scam has actually started in 1930, 2015, when in December, the 23rd, 1913, President Woodrow Wilson signed the Federal Reserve Act into law. How did it get to that? You know, this was the result of a secret concoction of some five bankers and financiers, congressmen, I think also, in 1911. They traveled secretly to Jekyll Island in Georgia, where during a week they kind of locked themselves up in a hotel room and concocted this brilliant but nefarious idea how to hegemonize the entire world with one currency, the U.S. dollar. Over two planned world wars and 100 years, the Federal Reserve Act and totally privately owned Federal Reserve Bank, which probably most people don't know, that the Federal Reserve Bank is totally privately owned, not only by bankers in the United States, but also in the UK, in France, in Italy, and in Germany. Of course, the majority is held in the U.S., and of course, a big chunk of that is with the Rothschild plan. So they built, basically, this was to build a worldwide dollar pyramid system based on a fiat money, because the dollar is not based on anything. It was for a while based on gold, and we get to that, but it's based on nothing. It's based today only on the fact that the dollar is still not very much, but still the major reserve currency in the world, and of course, it's still the currency with which all the energy should be paid. It's no longer the case that everything that is hydrocarbons is paid in U.S. dollars. For example, Russia and China have long ago detached from that, and others like Venezuela, for example, is also detached from that a couple of years ago. Iran, India, and so on. So also that is falling apart. And this was also a secret agreement that Father Bush, who was very close, or probably the whole Bush family is still very close to the House of Saud. And in the 70s, early 70s, they negotiated with the House of Saud that while they have, Saudi Arabia has the chair of OPEC, which is this consortium of oil-producing countries worldwide, and he calls the shots, so that Saudi Arabia would make sure that all the oil and gas would only be sold in U.S. dollars, you know. And as a thank you for that, Saudi Arabia will get constant and always protection, military protection, and protection from everywhere, from the United States. And this has basically happened up to today. And, of course, the U.S. then immediately built up, I don't know how many, I think about five U.S. Bases in Saudi Arabia, which, of course, are now used to help devastate the Middle East. But this is how the dollar has then become not only the world reserve currency, because at that point, that was in 1971, Nixon abandoned the gold standard because actually he ordered to the IMF, because the IMF is totally under control of the U.S. Treasury. So he told the IMF, let's forget the gold standard and we just have convertible currencies that are basically based on fiat and based on the U.S. dollar. Because with abandoning the gold standard, which used to be, and that was the problem of the gold standard, the gold value was not based on a basket of major currencies at that time, which would have been the dollar, the UK pound, the Deutsche Mark, the French franc, and maybe the Japanese yen. This was not the case. But the gold price, the $35 per ounce, which they decided, was based on the US dollar. So then automatically, when Nixon abandoned it through the IMF in 1971, the gold would immediately convert into the U.S. dollar. In other words, that what used to be gold as a reserve in many treasuries became automatically U.S. dollars. So that was a very smart move from the U.S. That meant that they could produce as many U.S. dollars as they wanted to because the world needed them for their reserve. And the second reason why they can produce and still produce as many dollars as they want, because the world also needs U.S. dollars to pay for their energy. Just about everybody needs oil and petrol, gas and petrol. So that's how we got where we are. I don't know whether anybody, maybe the Fed knows, but it's very, very difficult to know how many dollars actually are flooding the world, probably quadrillions. So this is one of the problems that led us where we are today.
So when we think about this, and we think about the dollar being the backstop or the reserve currency for most of the world's economy, what privilege does that convey to the United States, and what control? Because you talk about the fact that there's this U.S. dollar-controlled international transfer system. And again, I dare say that everybody listening to the podcast would say, I've never heard of this. It's called SWIFT. And that allows us, you tell us, to impose various sanctions and to really make certain that nations do the things that we want them to do here in the United States.
This is the third pillar, if you want to, for dollar control over every transfer, over every other currency in the world. Because if you transfer any amount, for example, international trade, much in addition to the petrol and gas that has been traded almost exclusively in U.S. dollars, as I said earlier, now less and less so, but still to a large extent, other international trade agreements are not established usually, or were not established usually, in local currencies, but in U.S. dollars. Never mind whether it was Argentina and Japan that they had an agreement together. It was, and there would be two completely different local currencies. It would be in U.S. dollars, and the same with any other currencies, except maybe lately with Europe, that as the euro has become basically the foster child of the U.S. dollar. So it doesn't make much difference. But this is how it happens. Okay, so if anybody transfers an amount of dollar to another country, like even $1,000, I would like to send $1,000 from Switzerland to Spain for some reasons. These $1,000 do not go from my Swiss bank directly to the Spanish bank where I want to transfer it. They go through a U.S. bank, either in London or in New York. Obligatory, they go through a U.S. bank. That's the Swiss system that is obliged to do that. And as all of that has to happen via U.S. bank, the U.S. can stop any transfer they want. They can do whatever they can stop. They can confiscate. They can do whatever they want. They can confiscate, like they did recently with in Venezuela, confiscate, or I call it stealing, their reserves, which are in the U.S. partly and in other countries in bank accounts, and just block the amount because it's in U.S. dollars. Maybe Venezuela and many other countries have not been fast enough in divesting the U.S. dollars into other currency. It's also not so easy if you have been depending on the U.S. dollar for many, many decades, or maybe in the case of many developing countries, for 100 years or so. You know, so it's not very easy to divest, but of course countries start divesting and do that even more.
Deal, the nuclear deal. You said that economic sanctions, so we can reimpose those if we, in fact, let a little off the gas during the time that we were part of that agreement. You say in whatever form they are effective only as long as the world uses the U.S. dollar for trading and as a reserve currency. Now, so then we can reimpose various sanctions on a country like Iran. Who enforces these sanctions? I mean, is it the power of the U.S. dollar and what that means to the ability for a country like Iran or Venezuela to trade around the world?
Okay, well, who enforces this? This is the U.S. banks with under the instructions, of course, of the Federal Reserve or the Treasury. And you also must understand, you do, I'm pretty sure, but most listeners do not, that there is basically no barrier between the Federal Reserve and Wall Street, the big Wall Street banks, about 20 or so. You know, it's like a revolving door. As we have noticed already with the Federal Reserve chairman, he goes to the Wall Street, he comes back, and so on. So it's a revolving door. So they work hand in hand. And so every Wall Street bank through which any transfer has to go can basically say, stop, halt, we are not making that transfer, we are blocking this amount of money. You know, so if, for example, Iran says, all right, we keep dealing with Europe because Europe would be, they haven't shown it yet, but would be brave enough to continue honoring the contracts for petrol and gas they have with us. Okay, they pay us, we ship gas, and they pay us in the currency the contracts were made. And this currency was either in dollars or in euros. And since everything has to go through the SWIFT system, through a U.S. bank, the U.S. bank can stop these payments, you know, and that's what they are doing actually with Venezuela. That's what they are doing with Iran. So my point is, when I said before, as long as the world uses the U.S. dollar, as long as Iran and Venezuela use the U.S. dollar, they are vulnerable. They can be punished by, you know, the U.S. deciding we'll stop a payment. They have done that in the case of Argentina, when Argentina said we are not going to cave into the vulture fund. You may remember a few years ago, they claimed for more than $100 billion that were never paid. And Argentina had agreements with all of its creditors. They agreed to a certain degree. I think it was an average of about 23 cents to the dollar that they would pay back. And Argentina paid back regularly. But since they refused to pay the full amount of this vulture fund, then the vulture fund agreed with the U.S. banks to stop the transfers. So Argentina was unable, even though they wanted to pay the creditors. The other creditors they had agreements with. So all of this happens under our watch, and nobody says beep, so to speak.
Now, the notion that the world is now de-dollarizing, that being the headline of the article that I'm referring to going back to July of 2019, tell us what that means, and are there percentages of transactions around the world that are now diminishing as it relates to the use of the dollar, and what are they using to take the place of the dollar? Is it cryptocurrency? Is it the currency of the individual nations trading amongst themselves without the U.S. bank involvement? Tell us what's happening.
Both of them. In the case of Venezuela, they have stopped about 2 or 3 years ago selling their petrol, especially one of their largest, certainly the largest customer is China. They have agreements, sales agreements with China to sell their petrol to China in yuan or in petros. You know, petro is a cryptocurrency that is based on the oil Venezuela has in the ground. The unfortunate part of that cryptocurrency is that it is based on the dollar value of the oil in the ground of Venezuela. In other words, it's still somehow linked to the dollar. Therefore, the deals they have now with, they're trying to detach it, but it's also not so easy. If we have time, I can get into this. But the deal they have with China is that China pays in gold convertible yuan. So, you know, the yuan is not only, of course, not a fiat money. It's based on the strong economy of China. On top of it, it is also backed by gold. Similar with the Russian ruble, which is also backed by gold and is backed by its own economy. Now, in the case of Iran, it's a little bit more tricky because in Iran, you have forces which would like to stay with the West, and you have other forces like the Ayatollah, who will pull to the east. So they have some agreements, of course, with China, which are dealt with entirely in yuan, and probably the same deal as with Venezuela in gold convertible yuan. But then they have other countries in which they probably still deal, and I know they do, otherwise it wouldn't hurt them so much. They still deal in U.S. dollars. And this is when I write about Iran. Iran can save itself. Of course, it's not easy because they have two forces, as I said, one that wants to stay with the West and the other one that wants to detach almost completely, like China and Russia are doing, and therefore be totally independent from these sanctions, you know. And this is a process. This is a process that doesn't happen very quickly. But you're right. There's this cryptocurrencies. There are more and more of these cryptocurrencies coming up. China has one. Russia has one. India is developing one. Iran has also either have done that already or in the process of doing it. And Venezuela, of course, has a cryptocurrency. Now, with these cryptocurrencies, the countries can deal with each other without going through a U.S. bank or without going through any bank, actually. You know, they deal with each other directly through the crypto accounts, their mutual crypto accounts. And this is eventually the best way. As long as a cryptocurrency has been created and is under the control of the government, I don't have much respect for privately owned cryptocurrencies, you know, like the Bitcoin and so. They lend themselves very often to fraudulent transactions. But if it's government controlled, you're kind of safe from that. You know, you can't really speculate with it as you can with the Bitcoin. We have seen the Bitcoin going up to 21,000, then falling back to about 3,000, and now it's I don't know where, about 6,000 or 7,000. So you know, these are currencies which I wouldn't call safe for daily trading, because there's too much speculation behind it. But as long as these are covered by government controls, I think they are fairly safe, and that may be a way out, one of the ways.
Okay, let me go to something that our president said yesterday. I heard him when he's screaming over the helicopters as he's leaving about a strong dollar. And he's saying, oh, the dollar is so strong, and the Chinese economy is in shambles. That's why people are rushing into our treasuries. And yet you point out that there are many countries, and countries that we really are concerned about our relationships with them for a host of reasons, including India and Turkey, which is a member of NATO, and that poses a whole separate set of issues for the United States. But you say that they're becoming much more involved with something called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Again, an organization that we've heard scant little about in the United States. So put together what we're hearing here and what's really going on around the world in the de-dollarizing process.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. You know, good that you mentioned it, because I wanted to get to that too. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization is an organization that was created 10 years ago, I don't know exactly when, not too long ago, by China and Russia. And then it contains, I think it was created in a meeting in Tajikistan, in one of those Central Asian former Soviet republics. And in the meantime, almost all these Central Asian countries are member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization of CEO. Also, other countries like India has joined, I think, last year. Pakistan has joined. Iran is about to join. Malaysia is on a wait list, started talking about it. Turkey certainly is. And if that happens, you know, you said Turkey is a NATO member. I don't know for how much longer, certainly with all the things that are going on, which do not please the United States. I believe Turkey will probably go totally eastwards. And that would then, of course, every move towards east and towards eastern currencies is a step towards de-dollarization. For example, Turkish currency, you know, as sanctioned, was manipulated through the Federal Reserve downwards by 40% within I think 18 months or so. Can you imagine what that means for the Turkish economy? So certainly they want a different type of relationship, a monetary relationship with the world. And to do that, if they join the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, they can largely detach from the dollar and will be outside the dollar system. Now, what that also means, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, they comprise probably about 50% of the world population. Can you imagine? Nobody talks about that in the West. Not only in the U.S. it's neglected. Until very recently, I've never read anything in Europe either about that. It's done on purpose. People should not know what exists in the East. Okay, they comprise about 50% of the world population, and about one-third, and gradually growing, about one-third of the world's GDP. In other words, these countries, if they really get together and have a closer, ever closer alliance, as is the case, you know, these things happen gradually, and that's in the process of happening, they don't need the West anymore. They can deal among themselves. They're totally self-sufficient. They can trade within themselves, with their own currencies. Possibly they will have, I think the idea is somehow to set up a basket of currencies where you would have a currency unit pretty similar to what the IMF has established as the special drawing rights, which I'm sure you have heard about it. This is a basket of currencies which includes the US dollar, mm-hmm. the English pound, the Japanese yen, the euro, and since about 2 years, also the yuan, the Chinese yuan. The Chinese have managed, against all the objections of the U.S. Congress, to finally become, to put the foot into the IMF SDR basket. What that means, and why I'm specially mentioning the SDR, is because if they are officially recognized by the IMF as a worldwide convertible currency, that means, you know, countries are rushing to buy yuans for their reserve and get rid of the dollar. That's part of the de-dollarization process. And they have achieved that. Now, lately, you referred to what President Trump said. He also said, we'll punish China for having devalued their currency. It's ridiculous that they punish nothing. What they are doing, they may go to the IMF and ask the IMF to kick out the yuan from the basket. That's a possibility. They could do that. They control the IMF. But even then, it wouldn't be that easy, because now many countries, the 193 member countries of the IMF, they would also have a say in it. And even though the U.S. has the veto and can overrule everybody, it will not be that easy, because they need some alliances. And many of these countries who have now adopted, in addition perhaps to the dollar that they still have, the yuan, they will be very unhappy if the yuan would be kicked out of the IMF. So of the IMF, of the SDR basket, sorry. So that's not so easy.
You wrote that the Western alliance is falling apart, so we might not have as many allies in going forward in some of the disputes we might have internationally. And I might be able to touch on that, but I want to stay where we are, because you talked about gold as our backstop until 1971. You say today the dollar is based not even on hot air, and is worth less than the paper is printed on. Now, many of us who follow this know that in public debt, we have about $23 trillion. But you point out rightly, because I've heard this from many other economists, that according to Forbes, about $210 trillion are unfunded liabilities. Now, this means all of the commitments we've made to future generations with Medicare, Social Security, against projections, if the tax system stayed the way it is. The question is, how vulnerable is the United States as people are de-dollarizing and as we're going more and more into debt? I mean, what are the precarious situations that could face the U.S. economy almost overnight if some of these things really all begin to congeal at one time?
If de-dollarization continues the way it does. And I don't think a collapse will happen overnight for the same reasons that I said before. It would be unlikely that the countries around the world would accept the yuan being kicked out of the SDR basket, namely because if China could, they have about $2 trillion, they have total more than $3 trillion worth of foreign reserves. Out of that, about two-thirds are in U.S. dollars. They could say tomorrow, and China wouldn't really care. That amount of money is not much for them. They could really say, okay, let's destroy the U.S. dollar and drop the $2 trillion they have on the market. That would crush the U.S. dollar, definitely. But they don't do that because many countries would suffer under it. Countries that have the dollar, they would also lose out, of course. They would lose their reserves or parts of their reserves, and many of them are allies or client countries of China, so they don't want to hurt them. And basically, it's not an idea that China wants to hurt any of the countries. Actually, they wanted to have friendly relations and deal with them. So these things are not going to happen very quickly, but they are going to happen gradually, and there's almost, I would say, there's no stopping that the U.S. dollar will eventually decline and become nothing more than perhaps a local currency. Now, there have been speculations, and I have already for years thought that the U.S. might, as a fallback position, call on the IMF to reinstate the gold standard, you know, any kind of a gold standard. It doesn't have to be the $35 per ounce. It can be any kind of relationship. And that would actually then possibly salvage the dollar. But I don't think, and that's again, you know, there's too many, we're too globalized for that to happen without any other country saying something. And I don't think that would be accepted by most of the countries that today are dealing with the U.S. and the U.S. has friendly relations with. So that is probably not going to happen, even though, you know, it's a possibility. I've heard speculations to that extent, and myself, I've thought that might be a way out for the U.S. But by and large, I really think this, you know, the ship is turning, and there is no return. The U.S. dollar will eventually cease being the world currency and may just be a normal currency. And that's okay, you know. So far, there has been so much punishment. And, you know, from, say, just take Venezuela, with all these sanctions that have been going on since about the middle of 2017, when the U.S. blocked Venezuela's access to international international money markets, that's when it started going bad. And from then on, the sanctions just increased. And, you know, there's a CPR, it's a think tank in Washington, D.C., very good one, actually. They have studied this with Jeffrey Sachs together, an old economics professor at Columbia University. And they have come to the conclusion that due to these sanctions, about 40,000 Venezuelans have died from lack of nutrition, died from lack of medical treatment, medication, hospital facilities, and so on, due to these sanctions. So this is a warfare. This is a direct warfare, and this is highly criminal. But nobody seems to pay attention to it, really.
So when we think about all of that powerful foreign force in the U.S. government, I mean, is it really the power of the Treasury Department, or is it the Defense Department? I mean, what worries people around the world more about the way we might impose our authority? Is it Treasury or Defense at this moment?
Well, it's both. You know, they work together. They work very closely together. I mean, there's no separation, absolutely. And so if these sanctions are imposed, then they're imposed probably hand in hand with what the Pentagon wants to achieve. And, I mean, the Pentagon is not alone either. There are forces behind the Pentagon that call the shots. And then we have NATO, which is of course ruled by the Pentagon too. And I just heard yesterday that the ambassador of Germany has repeated this threat in Berlin, saying to Madame Merkel, if you don't increase your contribution to the military budget, meaning NATO, to 2% of GDP, we may leave, NATO may leave Germany. I think, and then at the same time, I've seen a statistic that about 70% or close to 70% of the German people would love the U.S. to leave Rammstein. You know, that's a huge base in Germany. So this threat is so ridiculous. But I mean, all of this points to the fact that people are getting tired of these pressures. And instead of making allies to use the dollar, further use the dollar, they push them really away. They push them absolutely away from the dollar and into other currencies, into alternative trading even. And
let me ask
all
you
of
about,
this,
for example, the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative. And I want to point out the writing that you did about the Western Alliance falling apart, in particular about Pakistan and the investment that's going on there, because we are now beginning to talk seriously about whether we're getting out of Afghanistan. And, of course, we see the threat in Afghanistan more coming from across the border in Pakistan. And you're telling us in this piece that Pakistan and China are working very closely together. China is investing dramatic amounts of money in building the infrastructure of Pakistan. Put that together for United States foreign policy.
Yes, of course, the United States don't like that, because up to the inauguration last year of the new Pakistani Prime Minister, Mr. Imran Khan, Pakistan was sort of wavering between East and West, but very often was actually leaning more towards Washington. And so, you know, something like Turkey is doing or has been doing for a long time between East and West. And now they're also much more leaning towards East. But in the case of Pakistan now, you know, it's almost there's no return. China is with about $60 billion now involved through this Belt and Road Initiative by building infrastructure, road, railways, by building power plants to, you know, to renew the power schemes, which was always a problem in Pakistan. And therefore, there's and also in China, contrary to what other countries would do with private banking loans and sometimes probably horrendous interest, just look at Greece. China has long-term loans and concessionary conditions with these loans. Plus, they also encourage a large portion of Pakistani's own investment, so that they have a share in it and are interested in bringing this along. And this is going to happen not only with Pakistan. This is probably next going to happen also with India. And it's happening with all of Central Asia. And I'm sure it's happening already now with Iran. So this Belt and Road Initiative is something which, I mean, the targets have been set to 2049. Why? Because 2049 is a very important year for China. It's the 100th anniversary of the modern China, and now we are at the 7th anniversary of modern China. So this is important. But from my point of view, the Belt and Road Initiative is a proposition that will go on for at least 100 years, if not more. And will, I mean, it's imaginary if I say there will be hundreds of trillions or maybe quadrillions of dollars equivalent. No, of course, not yuans only, but local currencies that can be equated to either yuans or dollars today will be involved in these investments in the future. And all of that also means dollars not used in these in vital investments, but the Eastern currencies being used or local currencies being used. That's part of the de-dollarization process.
Peter Koenig, in closing, you've left us with a lot to think about. You're giving us a perspective that we don't hear very often in the United States. You're telling us that the United States, both with the alliances beginning to fracture, many different alliances, I don't know which you consider to the United States to be of greatest risk and peril, whether it's Turkey leaving NATO or Germany and Italy showing certain concerns about the United States and its influence in Europe, whatever it might be. And you can certainly comment on that, and the de-dollarization effort. If you were in the United States over the next 10 years, what would you be most aware of, or what should we think about that perhaps is not on the radar of most in the American public today?
Well, first of all, I think it will be very important for the American public to see through all of that, what that's going on. Then they can make their own opinion of what they think. They can they have a more background to elect the people or to go to the polls and so on. They should know, really. It should be much more transparent. All of this doesn't shine through. Now, I believe what is probably for the U.S. most important these days is Turkey. Turkey is a very important ally for many reasons. But the key reason is strategic position. Look at where Turkey is. I mean, it's between East and West, and it has one of the largest bases. I think there's more military personnel in Turkey than there is in Germany, or it's about the same. But I think it's almost the same. I think the largest NATO country, or the largest country where the largest U.S. contingent, military contingent, is Japan still. But Turkey leaving, would you imagine what that means? If Turkey is leaving NATO and would go to the east and join the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, that would be really a disaster. Why would it be a disaster? Not in the first place because Turkey is out, but because it may actually incite other countries that have doubts today. Like you mentioned Italy, certainly. I was recently in a conference, an anti-NATO conference in Florence, and there you could clearly see that the Italians are terribly upset with NATO. And Italy has so many different NATO bases and different NATO offices that it's becoming really nonsensical for many Italians. Then also Germany, as I mentioned before, Germany is about close to 70% of the population would be very happy if the U.S. would leave, if NATO would leave and take their nuclear bombs with them, and if all of that, still a slow process, but all of that would start getting in rolling, then the whole NATO structure could fall apart, and that of course would mean that the U.S. is also not only losing monetarily the hegemony over the world, but also militarily, if NATO would fall apart. Because without NATO, just the U.S. Army alone, I don't think would be strong enough to keep the control on the world as they claim to have now. So these two concerns, I think, we should keep in mind, and I think they would be of great interest for the American people to know, so they can make their own judgments on what to believe, that especially what Congress tells them, what the media tell them, and what the various presidents tell them is the truth. Most of it is not the truth. So, but they should have access to this information and be able to make their own opinion.
All right, Peter Koenig, thank you so much for a fascinating perspective. And if people want to read your writing, where can they find it generally? Because I think once they find it, they will be attracted to it. And even if they put it up against their own perceptions, it will give them a much better perspective from a different vantage point. I think it's really important.
But the one that is most prominent in publishing them, and is always one of the first ones, is Global Research. Global Research is based in Montreal, Canada, and is managed by an economics professor, Michel Chosudovsky, whom you probably have heard about or know. Yes. And so this is a very serious site, and it's very easy to get to. You go to www.globalresearch.org, I believe, or Canada.
.ca.
.ca. And that's where you find not only mine, of course, many, many other great articles of lots of people who think along the same lines and want to inform the rest of the world, including, of course, the North American public, of what is really going on. And of course, the Europeans. But I think it is very important that the North American public, I mean, also including Canada, is aware of what's really going on, and so that they can make their judgment and take the actions according to their judgments.
All right, Peter, thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Thank you very much for having me. It was great to talk to you, Larry.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com.